Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. One of our favorite guests on this program is a man who has earned a reputation for clarity and courage, for an ability to look, as they say in the military, over the horizon at what's coming, to anticipate it, to warn about it, and to encourage constructive steps to be taken in response. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. No stranger to this program, that's for sure. And for that matter, to the webinars that we have conducted as part of the work of the Committee on the Present Danger China, of which I'm very pleased to say Jim Fennell is a prominent member. We have distilled the essence of his most important contributions to those webinars, many, many others as well, in this new book, which I'm proud to say is actually an Amazon bestseller, thanks in part, I'm sure, to those of you listening to this program. We encourage you to take a look at it. We'll be talking about some of its insights with Jim Fennell. He is these days a senior fellow with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with ours in Washington. He is a man who has made a difference in uniform, notably rising through the ranks to that of captain and the chief of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet before his retirement. With all that said, Captain, there's hardly a minute left to talk to you about substance, but your distinguished record is important for people to understand, and we're so grateful to you for all you do, continuing to do for our country. Thank you, sir. Welcome aboard.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be back with you.
Thank you. I want to start, Captain, by asking you about a part of the world you know well. It's the South Pacific, part of the larger region in which the Chinese Communist Party is now increasingly operating aggressively. Well, that would be worldwide, to be honest, but specifically I'm thinking of the Western Pacific. President Joe Biden was out in that neck of the woods for a meeting with the G7 in Hiroshima, Japan, and then was scheduled to go south to Papua New Guinea and meet with a number of leaders of nations out there, as well as on to Australia to meet with the so-called Quad. He decided to cut short his trip to come back and work the budget debt ceiling, you know, thrash in Washington. Give us your sense, sir, of the missed opportunity there and its repercussions, both with the people that were supposed to be meeting with him and, as importantly, Xi Jinping, his old friend, the Chinese Communist dictator.
Yeah, Frank, President Biden's decision not to go to Papua New Guinea and then also down to Australia for the Quad meeting sends a signal to the people of the region, and it's not a partisan statement. Any president that would announce that they were going to go there and then didn't follow through or didn't send a senior level replacement like the vice president sends a signal that the people of the South Pacific are essentially a second tier. And so what we're seeing already in the news and the reactions from that region is lots of questions, lots of doubt about the U.S. commitment to the region. How strong is it? And certainly Beijing and what they're responding and writing and using this is that they're sowing the seeds of doubt amongst the world in their own press and talking about how the United States isn't committed to the region. So regardless of whatever the reason was, the impacts are not good. And it continues to perpetuate what they've already felt since the end of World War II. And you can just read, go to any island and there's somebody commenting about American commitment to the region. And, you know, this administration had made some kind of efforts to put them on the agenda. They met with Pacific Island leaders in Washington, D.C. They were supposed to meet with the Pacific Island Forum leaders in Papua New Guinea. We had, you know, announced a new embassy in the Solomon Islands. So there were there was some hope that this is really something new and that the United States government, regardless of party, was going to follow through with its commitments. And so I see this as a really a missed opportunity, and one that must be immediately followed up with some kind of demonstration of commitment. And I'm not sure what's in store, but we don't really hear much about this. And it seems to be as business as usual.
Yeah. Jim, you've studied this region closely, and all of that would be bad enough. But what I'm particularly concerned about is whether Xi Jinping has been further emboldened by this latest evidence of what I have to tell you, sure looks like Joe Biden doing what he has done pretty consistently since he came to office, which is harming our vital interests and benefiting those of China. And I'd ask you to just comment on this particular point. Trevor Loudon has on this program and elsewhere talked about a phenomenon called little big mouth, big help, I think is the formulation by which he means, or more to the point, by which the Chinese mean, you can get away with, you know, saying things that are not particularly helpful to us, that are, in fact, you know, at odds with our direct interests. But as long as you're giving us the big help on things that matter, it's okay. A controlled asset, in other words, like Joe Biden, can get away with having the G7 meetings and, you know, the focus on the threat from China and all that, as long as it doesn't matter very much, like I think these meetings would have in the South Pacific. Your thoughts, sir?
Yeah, I think that the phrase that Trevor uses is correct. I think in this case, the Chinese haven't been really, especially now, they had a lot of commentary about the G7, and there was a lot of, you know, bluster in their press about how bad this was and an American hegemony and trying to contain China. But at the end of the day, they got President Biden to say in Hiroshima, you know, that silly spy balloon really changed everything. And if we hadn't had that balloon, we could get back to having good relations. And I'm here to tell you, we're going to start thawing this relationship out. So in some sense, he has said some things that were remarkable, and that was one of them. And on the other hand, they got him not to go down, or I don't know if they got him to do that, but he didn't go. And so now what we have is, you know, we won't see it, but then there were some reflections in the press, the PRC press, but what we should recognize is because we weren't there and we didn't send the President of the United States and all that comes with that, we will start to see the Chinese diplomatic corps, their wolf warriors. Maybe they're not wolves anymore. There's some debate in certain circles about how aggressive the diplomacy, if Xi has made a new tack in his diplomacy, but you can expect that PRC diplomats are going to be, along with their state-owned enterprises, seeking to further entrench themselves into the South Pacific and drive a wedge between the United States and Australia and New Zealand and put that area of the world at off limits to the United States and our strategic interests.
Jim, we've got less than a minute. Just very quickly, what are those strategic interests and why would that be a bad thing?
Well, the region provides $5 trillion of a business that connects the world and the global economy. Now, some people talk against globalism, but for the practical matter is we buy and sell and trade, and our businesses exist because we have free access to the seas. And if China can get through the South Pacific, and as I use the phrase, if they can stick an iron bar, the PLA Navy, through the South Pacific, they control that then. They have another avenue of being able to control global trade and affect our economy and our livelihoods.
Right. And perhaps minerals and other resources in those waters as well, and the airspace and so on. We're going to come back with more with with Captain Jim Fennell, United States Navy retired, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
Last week, the Committee on the Present Danger of China hosted an important webinar entitled, Is Joe Biden a Controlled Asset of the Chinese Communist Party? Events of this week reinforce our answer in the affirmative. True, Beijing professed unhappiness with the G7's discussions in Hiroshima, Japan about the rising threat that the CCP's continuing unrestricted warfare poses to freedom everywhere, and the prospect that it may soon include a shooting war as well. Yet, far more significant is what Xi Jinping's old friend Joe Biden did by standing up 18 leaders of nations in the Indo-Pacific region who were supposed to meet with him in Papua New Guinea. This meeting could have materially set back Chinese efforts to penetrate and subvert those still resisting its colonization and domination of the region and beyond. Instead, the war drums are sounding more loudly. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, visiting with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, the former Chief of Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. In that role, he was, well, years ahead of his time in terms of understanding the threat we were facing from the Chinese Communist Party, warning his superiors, who unfortunately largely chose to ignore rather than to respond as they should have a decade or more ago to the danger that is now very much upon us, as Jim Fennell predicted, the decade of concern. We're in the middle of it. And Jim Fennell, let me just ask you, you've talked about the strategic region of the Western Pacific, the Southern Pacific reaches particularly. Of course, the entire Pacific has enormous strategic, interests for us, a nation that borders the eastern flank of it and that does enormous amount of trade and has very important security arrangements with nations scattered across those waters. Another part of the Chinese aggression at the moment, as you know, and we've talked about this before, is they're establishing beachheads or ports and other power projection potential assets along the littoral of Latin America with the Pacific. Talk a little bit about this Belt and Road Initiative as you see it as a vehicle for being well behind our lines in a sense strategically and otherwise being able to exercise dominion over not just the Western Pacific, but perhaps much of the rest of it as well by the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, Frank, the Belt and Road Initiative, originally called the One Belt, One Road Initiative back in 2013, is now 10 years into its in existence. And it was also started alongside this Asia Investment Infrastructure Bank, AIIB. And those together formed this vision that Xi had to spread China's economic connections and pathways across Central Asia into Europe, and you know through and through what we see now even into more of Europe and into Africa. In addition, though, it's also as you mentioned into Latin America. So there was no historic 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago Chinese trade with Latin America, but they've placed this all under the rubric of the Belt and Road Initiative. And so you have countries that are now majority of the countries in South America have aligned themselves with China in the Belt and Road Initiative. And we're starting to see reflections of that. We've been seeing it, but it's now becoming more obvious, I think, just to the general public, which is that China is starting to influence the different governments down there to be more receptive to dealing with the United States to trade in Chinese currency and not
with
U.S.
With China, currency. You mean?
Yeah, with China, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. To trade with China using their currency as the base for the economic relationship. So we're seeing China's Belt and Road essentially grip around the world, and there needs to be a stand up to that in terms of how we respond, because if they're able to devalue the United States' preeminence in terms of U.S. dollar, and it will take some time, and I know there's a lot of debate on where that is and how quickly it could happen, but the fact of the matter is, if they start pushing and going in that way as they have been, there's an inertia that comes, and more countries will be inclined to join it. We just saw here in 8 days, we're going to see China now be able to trade goods in the Russian port of Vladivostok in the Sea of Japan with no tariffs. So we're seeing some incredible, now there's reasons for that with their relationship with Russia, but we're seeing the Chinese government, through what they call comprehensive national power, use all elements of their government, mainly their diplomats and their state-owned enterprises that come along with their diplomats to provide loans and to provide services and to show that you can work with us and we will buy and trade with you and we won't hold you to some conditions that maybe the United States or Europe will, and they're able to continue to grow this. And they're taking some losses in some places, but for them, the long game is to be able to have those positions in places like Latin America, where all of a sudden, which we had thought was our Monroe Doctrine, our hemisphere, our backyard, we're now starting to see governments like Brazil, cozy up to and follow the PRC's directives, essentially.
Well, sadly, I think, unfortunately, at the moment, it's the case that basically from the Arctic to the Antarctic, the Western Hemisphere is now populated by countries, every major country at least, that is now either Marxist governed or aligned with Marxists in their government. And it's chilling. And just on two quick points, Jim. One is, as a military strategist and intelligence professional, presumably what this gives the Chinese, and it's not just Latin America, of course, we're focusing on there, but Africa, it's South Asia, it's Central Asia, it's Southeast Asia, it's Europe, so I could argue Canada, and to some extent even our own country, that have now got these Chinese assets, these infrastructure colonial build-outs, if you will, that lend themselves, they're designed, I think, in every case to, have a dual purpose. And if they wind up being operated by the Chinese, as well as effectively owned by them, especially if they foreclose on the developing nations that don't make their payday loan payments for the build-out costs, those would all be essentially available to the People's Liberation Army for power projection, some maybe more than others, but is that not a problem truly globally? And if we do find ourselves in a shooting war, which we'll talk about more in a moment, but if that is in fact in prospect, it would be global on a character that makes every other world war we've contended with pale by comparison, would it not?
Yeah, I agree, Frank. I mean, a lot of people will disagree with that and say that's fear-mongering, but the reality is, the Chinese have said what their end state is for 1 October 2049. It is to be the global superpower. That's what they say. They say it over and over. They write it. They're not hiding it. And they also talk about many other things. They want to have the biggest and strongest military, and they want to have the biggest economy. Well, part of that is linking those things together. And they also frequently talk about America has 800 bases around the world. And they use that as a benchmark. And it's almost in a weird way to me, it's like they're saying, we are going to have the same, because they want to replicate what we've had, but expand upon it with their own vision of how they see it. So the idea that all these diplomatic or economic outposts and outreaches in the Belt and Road are going to stay strictly economic and, cash only kind of exchanges for, mercantile, system of barter, I think that's foolish. I think we need to understand that they work together and they're not decoupled in terms of the comprehensive national power strategy that the PRC and the Chinese Communist Party employ, says that all elements of power, levers of national power, are integrated. So the idea that you've got a state-owned enterprise that's building a railroad in Indonesia today doesn't mean that in 20 years from now, PLA Navy warships may not be making port calls in some facility in Indonesia. It's just foolish to not think that. We thought that the Chinese wouldn't grow the biggest Navy in the world 25 years ago. They have it today. We never envisioned that China would have 350 nuclear ICBM silos in the middle of central and western China. They do today. We never thought that China.
That was last year, as I recall.
Right.
Very recently.
We never said Chinese aircraft carriers would operate east of Taiwan while they're shooting ballistic missiles. They are today. So, I mean, there's all kinds of things that we've missed.
We've missed, but you generally have not, Captain Fennell, and that's one of the reasons why we delight in having a chance to visit with you, and we're going to pick up on the other side of a short break for a third installment of this very important conversation with the former Chief of Intelligence for the Pacific Fleet of the United States Navy, right after this.
Night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. I'm delighted to say Captain Jim Fennell is in the house virtually still for another installment of Securing America. Captain, we've set the stage for a drill down on two topics that I think are vitally important. I'd be very interested in your thoughts on them. One is, it appears that there are sizable numbers of unaccompanied fighting age Chinese men who seem to be very fit, who are said to be carrying identical packs and canteens. And according to our colleague, Michael Yan, who has some experience in the military himself, as you know, as well as years of combat journalism reporting, he says it appears to him, at least, that they are moving as units through the Darien Gap and on up across the southern border of the United States. I've heard told there's some coming from the north as well, but I'm less certain about that. The numbers total that I'm hearing, and I'm not quite sure where they come from, is the equivalent over the past few months of five battalions, which I think is roughly 5,000 individuals. The question to you, sir, is if, as I believe you have said here before, you think it likely that if the Chinese Communist Party goes to a shooting war with us over Taiwan, it will not be confined to Taiwan or to the Western Pacific even, but our own territory may be struck. Would it surprise you if they have put into place the cadre needed to create insurgent operations inside the United States mainland in such an eventuality? And with what effect?
Well, Frank, I mean, there's not very much, if any, written evidence about that kind of thinking from the Chinese or any in terms of special operations, insurgency operations in mainland USA. But when you have literally millions of people come across the border, and I've talked to Michael, I've seen his videos, I've seen Chinese people, I've heard them say, I'm from China, on his videos. So we know for a fact that Chinese people, as you mentioned, are coming across the border. The idea that 5,000 of them came across out of 5 million, it's not implausible in any way, shape, or form that they're here now, and they could have been sponsored by the PLA as part of some kind of contingency. And now that you've had, I'll focus on the spy balloon, but they have other reconnaissance as well. But when you put all this, we call it ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance activities together that they're doing, they're going to know where there are certain places that probably, if you could do certain things, blow up a fuel depot, take out a comms or a radar or a satellite comm dish or something like that, that you're going to have significant impact on the U.S. military's ability to respond to defending Taiwan. And the idea that they would do that, it's not far-fetched. It may sound far-fetched to some, but I don't think it should be, given the fact that we're seeing so many people come across from mainland China. And that should alarm a lot of people. And they're not being vetted. So we don't have any way of knowing and refuting this. So why would we defer to say, oh, it can't be happening? We should be saying, this is likely. What are we doing to make sure that it's not true?
Do you think it's likely, Captain, that we have 5 battalions worth of special operators inside communist China at the moment?
I can't say, Frank. I just said, I would say is it's not impossible. And given the fact that we know that Chinese have come across, now some of them have said, yeah, I'm here.
Let me just correct. I'm saying, do you think it's possible that we have 5 battalions of special operators inside communist China at the moment?
I would think that would be, it's almost impossible, yeah, given the way
that's Chinese, the answer I expected.
the Chinese security system and the People's Armed Police is larger. You know, they spend more money on the People's Armed Police than they do on the PLA. So there's an infinitesimal small chance. And oh, by the way, people probably don't know, but what's been being started to report here in the last week is that there's been a crackdown on foreign activities in China. Now, this is related to the music industry in Beijing, where foreign bands are not being allowed or being booked. And foreigners, if there's a band of Chinese, a band of 10, say it's 10 people in a Chinese band, and one of them's a foreigner, that foreigner will not be allowed to go on stage. And foreign bands are not being booked outright. And this is a growing story, but I guess what I'd say is it just feeds to your question, which is there's no way that we're operating like that over there.
They take internal security very seriously, not least because they don't trust their own people, of course, and the whole social credit system and the like is operating to control them. Captain Fennell, let me ask you one last question. You provide an immensely important service to people like me in distributing information about the China threat. It's group is called Red Storm Risen, as I recall. I got that
Red
right.
Star Risen.
Red Star. Your Google group is entitled Red Star Risen. And one of the things that came across the transom this morning was a piece in which a captain, former colleague of yours, I imagine, Brett Sadler, has talked about essentially the Chinese naval power now surpassing our own, not just the number of ships, but in terms of actual capability as well, which raises the question. In fact, he talks about some aspects of this, including not just the number of vessels and their armaments and so on, but also the industrial base that supports them as being very much asymmetrically disfavoring us these days, specifically the industrial capabilities. To the extent all that matters in terms of what would almost certainly be a maritime fight in the Pacific with China, where do you see, our relative position, and does it further encourage, we talked about this earlier on, does it further embolden a guy like Xi Jinping to think he can take chances, if not with impunity, at least with acceptable costs in taking us on as well as Taiwan and others?
Yeah, Frank, I was glad to see Brett's article. I was surprised actually to see it in Epoch Times. That to me was an indicator of how serious this is that even somebody from the more, staid Heritage Foundation would want to get their message out to as many platforms as possible. So that was glad to see that. I agree with what Brett wrote. It's something we've been talking about and warning about, some of us, for quite a long time. We should have been addressing this industrial shipbuilding decline that the United States has been on for the last 50 years. We should have addressed it 25 years ago, clearly, and we haven't. So we're in a bit of a really bind right now. And so people are starting to, recognize the threat and are starting to scramble to come up with options of what we could do. Obviously, trying to refurbish or expand the existing seven major naval shipyards that we have is obviously the first option. Second option is to seek to expand production in other naval shipyards with our allies. And so you'll see reporting and articles about that. And I think there's going to be more work on that. If we can go to places like Japan or Korea or Australia or the Philippines and have folks to be able to help us produce the ships that we need with the armaments that we need to be able to sink the Chinese Navy. There's also requirements, I think, that need to look at our old mothball fleets, ships that we still have that have been unmanned and are basically in a mothball status. How could we bring those out and use them? And there's going to be naysayers are going to say it costs too much time, too much effort. We're going to have roadblock for that. And it's going to take somebody with strong leadership to blow through that. And I guess what I would say is, as we approach that, if we approach that, this will probably factor into Xi's calculation in terms of this decade of concern, where he has ordered the PLA to have the capability to take Taiwan as early as 2020. Here we are 3.5 years later. And the likelihood that he wouldn't want to take military action much past 2030. And we think it's probably closer to 2025 based on statements and things that we're seeing. And if he starts to recognize that the United States is going to start to build up its capacity to destroy the PLA Navy, that may cause him to start moving. So we're in a really bad situation, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't start trying to have that capacity. And we need it now. We need all hands on deck. We need the Army, the Air Force. There was a great special on 60 Minutes Australia over the weekend where it showed what the U.S. Army is doing in terms of bringing anti-ship cruise missile fires to the region. That's good. I'm glad. You know, I want everybody in the U.S. military that can contribute to sinking the PLA Navy to be there. Because if we can sink the PLA Navy, they may hurt us with bombers. They don't have that many, but they could hurt us still, and they have rockets, but they're going to be severely restricted if they cannot put a fleet to sea. That's just a fact of history. And so we need to be focused as a nation on how do we destroy the PLA Navy as quickly as possible with every asset that we have and some that we haven't thought of.
I know, Jim Fennell, you were as heartened as I was by this memo that a four-star Air Force general by the name of Michael Minahan published, in which he basically warned of an imminent war with China and recommended some creative ways to bring more firepower and capability to bear using existing assets and platforms, unmanned vehicles and the like among them. I'm excited to have the chance to continue this conversation with you, Captain Fennell. As I say, you're one of our favorite guests. As always, you've lived up to expectation with a really, really important contribution to the program today. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again very soon and stay well in the meantime. We'll be right back with more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last week, the Committee on the Present Danger China hosted an important webinar entitled, Is Joe Biden a Controlled Asset of the Chinese Communist Party? Events of this week reinforce our answer in the affirmative. True, Beijing professed unhappiness with the G7's discussions in Hiroshima, Japan, about the rising threat that the CCP's continuing unrestricted warfare poses to freedom everywhere, and the prospect that it may soon include a shooting war as well. Yet, far more significant is what Xi Jinping's old friend Joe Biden did by standing up 18 leaders of nations in the Indo-Pacific region who were supposed to meet with him in Papua New Guinea. This meeting could have materially set back Chinese efforts to penetrate and subvert those still resisting its colonization and domination of the region and beyond. Instead, the war drums are sounding more loudly. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest, another favorite of this team. His name is Jonathan Emord. He is a constitutional attorney and author of The Authoritarians, which describes the phenomenon of authoritarianism dating from the 19th century to the present. He is a candidate for the United States Senate from Virginia, among other things, a formidable intellect and a man we always value when we have a chance to talk with him about threats to our beloved Constitution. And we're going to do that today. Jonathan, it's great to have you back. Welcome once again.
Good to be with you.
I wanted to start by asking you about something that has been forecast for some time by us, among others, as a serious problem for our constitutional republic. And that would be I call it the global governance gambit that Xi Jinping, the Chinese dictator, the World Economic Forum of Davos fame, the Big Pharma and Bill Gates sort of oligarchs, and not least, of course, the World Health Organization, have been seeking to essentially give the World Health Organization, or WHO, authorities that they've never had before, not only to advise about transnational health crises like pandemics, but how to actually decide when a nation has one, and then to dictate to that nation what must be done in response. How big a problem would that be if, as is now in prospect, our colleague and friend Michelle Bachmann was telling Steve Bannon about this just yesterday, if, in fact, the World Health Assembly, as it's called, votes to establish such arrangements going forward?
Well, it violates fundamentally sovereignty, the sovereignty of our people and our nation. And the Constitution is unique in all the world in its creation of our republic and in its vesting of the power to make law exclusively in the Congress of the United States and the power to enter into a treaty exclusively in the Senate of the United States with a supermajority of 3/4 vote. And our
two-thirds, I think.
Two-thirds, I'm sorry. And with the Bill of Rights giving a safeguard yet again beyond the limited powers delegated under the Constitution to the three branches of government, we have a Bill of Rights which forms a second safeguard, and we have a dual federalist system, which is a third safeguard, all for the purpose of protecting individual rights, individual sovereignty. And what this does, what these international agreements are doing, is divesting us of sovereignty, but giving powers that are lawmaking for our own country to international bodies, and giving powers that decide in future, and as they happen, what constitutes a basis for invoking government power in the United States to act against the free will of patients, physicians, economic actors, So what is this? This is a substitution for constitutional governance, world governance, comprised not of those we elect, but the arbitrary heads selected largely by Beijing through its influence, in a world order that is defined more by our enemies than by ourselves. So we can't allow this to happen. And we have to rise up, and we have to work against it. And there are many ways of doing it. It's not just individual action. It's not just action by members of Congress. All of that is essential, but it's also action by governors of the states, and it's actions by the attorney generals. We all have to assert our legal protections under the Constitution and ensure that the foundational aspects of this, the exclusive authority to make law, these fundamentals, which are now at stake, are defended against all of these intruders that are coming down from above, from other foreign nations.
This is a really helpful way to characterize the thing, as well as the national sovereignty and threats to the Constitution by which we are all governed. There is, as you've said, a personal sovereignty impact as well, to the extent that, you know, you could have this unaccountable international organization directing what your doctor can do in the course of treating you, for example. And we saw some of that, of course, in the pandemic. I call it pandemic 1.0. But I have the feeling that if it's not just an advisory body that is giving you that advice, but it's one that has the ability to, at least theoretically, compel you to do such things, presumably with the help of our government, which is conniving to negotiate this transfer of sovereignty, this transfer of power, for that matter, it would be a whole different kettle of fish, I think, and very bad indeed. Jonathan, in that regard, when you talk about the degree to which this is being done in defiance of certain constitutional arrangements, notably the Senate's right and responsibility, duty to advise and consent to treaties, is one of those important safeguards. And as you say, the founders wisely insisted that a supermajority be required to adopt, in a sense, outside of our normal lawmaking process, you know, arrangements that could impinge upon the Constitution, as this certainly would. And yet, in this case, the Senate of the United States, by a 49-47 vote, declined to perform its duty to advise and consent to whatever agreements come out of this World Health Organization negotiation. We have to take a short break, but when we come back, I want to ask you about, doesn't that really constitute a not only breach of their duty under the Constitution, but really their sworn oath to support and defend the Constitution as well? We'll talk about that and much more with Jonathan Emord, the author of The Authoritarians, on the other side of a very short break, including what also we have just seen impinging upon the rule of law in our country in the wake of this Durham prosecution report. So stay tuned for all of that right after this.
We're back.
And we're speaking with Jonathan Emort, a constitutional expert and attorney and the author of The Authoritarians. I strongly commend it to all of you. Jonathan, we were talking before the break about the extent to which the World Health Organization and what is being brought to us by the Chinese communists and the World Economic Forum and others in the way of a transfer of power and sovereignty from our country and constitutional republic to, well, wholly unaccountable, unelected bureaucrats in Geneva. One of the questions that occurred is, where's the United States Senate in safeguarding our rights and the powers of our country? And it seems as though they're not only absent without leave, but they've essentially taken a dive. Your thoughts?
Yes. So we have this Ron Johnson bill that went down. Tim Kaine, actually, my opponent in the United States Senate race in Virginia, is responsible for being the mouthpiece that aided that to happen through an act of subterfuge. He misled the Senate into thinking they couldn't vote for two pieces of legislation, that they had to vote against this Ron Johnson bill in order to preserve the their position on the underlying bill. Nonetheless, this, from a bigger standpoint, is an unconstitutional action, not just because it violates the treaty clause, but because it takes delegated powers and reserved powers, delegated powers to the federal government, certain powers, and reserved powers of the states, and divests those from those centers to international authorities that are beyond the reach of the American people. So this is a real threat, a very serious threat to sovereignty, and it is unconstitutional on many levels, not just the treaty making power. And it's a separation of powers violation as well, because to the extent that it is an exclusive legislative authority, the president is acting unilaterally as if by executive order, indeed by executive order, to achieve an accord that divests that legislative power from the Congress of the United States to an international body. So there are many levels of constitutional violation here, all of which justify action by those affected. In the first instance, it may be the Senate of the United States. Individual Republican senators should work at the earliest opportunity when they have standing to proceed against this in federal court. In addition, the state, you know, governors and attorneys general need to act as soon as this thing becomes operational to interdict it through federal action in the courts. There needs to be really a movement afoot to do that.
Well, I think the most urgent movement that we need now is to get us out of the World Health Organization, and that's what we're working on as part of our Sovereignty Coalition. And I encourage people to take a look at the American Sovereignty Declaration at sovereigntycoalition.org. It's a very important piece of expressing your attitude towards these violations of your rights and potentially our freedoms and our country writ large. And there's an online act feature that once you've signed the declaration at sovereigntycoalition.org will enable you to communicate what you've done and why you would like your elected representatives in Congress to follow suit. And I hope that you will do all of that. Jonathan, let me quickly, in the space of a couple of minutes that we have left, turn to another topic. As a constitutional scholar and lawyer, I'm sure that you looked closely at the contents of a report by John Durham, the special prosecutor charged with looking into what on earth was done to Donald Trump in the run-up to the 2016 election and thereafter. What did you make of it, and in particular, the failure to prosecute any of the people who were pretty clearly in its findings identified as having engaged in criminal misconduct?
Right. It's a gross violation of equal justice under law. It is a gross violation of the basic rules and regulations that have governed the Department of Justice and the FBI in the conduct of their actions. So you have, on the one hand, with regard to Hillary Clinton and the Clinton-Cain campaign, you have this approach in which they refuse to take any action whatsoever, despite incredible amounts of evidence of unlawful activity, violations of the Espionage Act, corruption, abuse of power, collusion with foreign powers that might invite investigation, the very things they were accusing Trump of. Yes. Which they actually
committed. With the very power that they were accusing him of engaging in, namely Russia.
And then with regard to Trump, then you have the second standard of justice, in which they did not go through any of the processes they ordinarily do to validate evidence. New evidence, the Steele dossier was completely fraudulent, knew that from the get-go. Knew it was coming from the Clinton-Cain campaign and that it had been purchased by them. And you have every reason under all of their criteria to recognize this as biased and unreliable, and yet they willingly, knowingly defrauded the FISA courts, willingly, knowingly commenced and expended federal or taxpayer dollars for a full-blown criminal investigation, knowing the entire time that it was predicated on a fabrication. So this is a huge indictment, and it covers... It covers the entire leadership at FBI and DOJ. And what it tells us is that there needs to be a massive cleaning of house there. And in addition, new safeguards need to be put into place. Jurisdictional limits need to be put into place. Means to second guess the execution of actions need to be put in place to ensure equal justice under law, to ensure never again that there is a coup d'etat attempt that was done here.
Jonathan, I just have to say in closing, you ironically said it's an indictment. It is indicting for sure, but it is not an indictment. And that's the piece that goes right to the point you made at the outset. And that is, equal justice is not being provided under the law. And there's hardly anything I can think of that it's more corrosive to a democratic republic like ours. Jonathan, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Come back to us again soon. God bless you and your work, and good luck with your campaign. Thanks to all of you for joining us. I hope you do so again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.